You love podcasts, the stories, the laughs, the unexpected turns. But when this episode ends, the silence starts. Not anymore. Audiobooks.com turns that silence into your next great adventure. With over 450,000 titles, from bestsellers to hidden gems, your love for listening just found its new best friend. And because you already know the joy of audio, we're giving you 3 free audiobooks to start your journey. Imagine your favorite podcast, now with unlimited episodes. That's audiobooks.com. Keep the story going. Sign up for your free trial at audiobooks.com/podcastfree today. Because for podcast lovers like you, the end of an episode is just the beginning. That's audiobooks.com/podcastfree.
Hey, you, listening right there. Yeah, you, our most wonderful listener in the whole world. I want to thank you and all the people like you who support this show and everything we do at the Major Spoilers Podcast Network. And for those of you that are currently contributing at patreon.com/majorspoilers, thank you, thank you, thank you. And for those of you who are not or can't, there are a lot of other ways that you can support this show. You can share a review, you can tell a friend, or maybe you can just go check us out at patreon.com/majorspoilers, see what we're all about. And maybe at some point in the future, like I'm seeing someone just posted this week, hey, finally made the jump and decided to support Major Spoilers on patreon.com/majorspoilers. That's wonderful. And I certainly thank all of you very, very much for keeping this little thing that we've been doing for the last 13 years going. And hopefully we can continue to do it another 13 years. Thanks so much.
The Major Spoilers Podcast covers news, reviews, and of course, spoilers, and goes into details about the topics discussed. So if you haven't read, listened, or watched the items we talk about, you might want to come back later.
I'm Matthew.
I'm Rodrigo.
And I'm Steven, and you're listening to the Major Spoilers Podcast, the podcast for pop culture and comic fans.
In this issue, Major Spoilers presents the Justice Society of America versus the Soulless Stalker from Beyond in a battle for all the marbles. We'll cover the latest in video games, comic books, movies, TV, and more, all delivered in the Major Spoilers manner by your star-studded cast of characters, including America's sweetheart, me. Brought to you by Loosener's Castor Oil Flakes, the all-weather breakfast. Put in your beanies and get out the Dakota rings, because the Major Spoilers Podcast is on the air and you need to drink more Ovaltine.
Welcome to issue 839 of the Major Spoilers Podcast. Thank you so much for downloading and checking us out this week. I know some days are just full of bad news. Some days are just full of things that you don't want to think about. You have personal tragedies or greater tragedies that are happening. I'm hoping that this week we can bring a little levity to your day and a little fun and enjoyment as we talk about pop culture goodness and craziness. Let's jump into some of the news that has been going on in the last couple of weeks. As we can choose from, Dr. Fate is part of the new Legion of Superheroes. Also, there's a Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy coming to Hulu. And we took a look at the new Joker trailer, and we have some thoughts on that. Let's spin the Wheel of Destiny. Let's see where this lands. Round and round it goes, and there it lands on the new trailers for the Joker. Now, this is a DC Universe property. This is a Warner Brothers picture. But the creators, the director and scriptwriters have said, oh, yeah, comic book fans are going to hate us because we are not doing anything from the comic books in this movie. And have you guys had a chance, Matthew and Rodrigo, to see the most recent trailer or a trailer for The Joker?
When did the most recent one come out?
San Diego Comic-Con a couple of weeks ago.
Oh, yeah, I think so. Yeah.
Yeah. What are your initial reactions to that?
I mean, it doesn't look like a movie I would like.
Okay.
I mean, it's like Batman's okay, but I enjoy your Dark Knight about as much as I enjoy your Batuzzi kind of stuff. You know, it's like Batman's fine, pretty much uniformly. Whatever he's doing, it's cool. So it's not my devotion to the Joker character that makes me think that I'm not going to like it. It just kind of looks like a gritty drama about somebody slowly losing aspects of their life that they care about and then probably becoming a murderer. So I'm like, is that a movie that I actually want to watch? I don't think it is.
No, I see where you're coming from. No Batman in this movie. So we don't have to worry, at least in everything that we've been told, that there's no Batman in this movie.
They're lying.
But I don't know. I think they really are not putting a Batman in this movie for a reason. Because whenever I see this movie, every time I see this trailer or the trailers for this movie, I sit there and go, wow, imagine if this is 1970, whatever it is, and you're seeing Taxi Driver trailers for the first time. And this feels like we are hitting that cycle of pop culture where people are starting to look at these influences and saying, hey, what if we made a or what if we had a different take on Taxi Driver, but we were using a DC character in this case to tell that same kind of loner outcast from society and his slow descent into madness. I am very intrigued by this movie myself, just because of the visuals and some of the just interesting bits that I see in that trailer. It just from that, and again, we don't know, you know, what the story is, etc. But just from the visuals, it feels very late 1970s, you know, coming out of Vietnam War era movie spirit of the times. And I'm kind of interested to see what the modern take on that is. So I'm kind of interested in seeing where we're going with this. Matthew, have you seen the trailer?
Yeah.
And what is your take?
I don't care. I mean, this is clearly not a movie for me. I was actually interested when they said Todd Phillips, because I thought that Todd Phillips did Welcome to the Dollhouse, but that's actually Todd Solondz.
Uh-huh.
And I really enjoy the stuff that Solondz has done. Todd Phillips, I'm like, oh, good. It's the guy from The Hangover, whatever. But I don't know. It just doesn't feel like a movie that's going to scream out for my attention. I will probably catch it on cable somewhere down the line.
Mm-hmm.
It's not like I'm going to actively avoid it, but you know, I enjoy Joaquin Phoenix and stuff. Space Camp was one of my favorite movies back in 1983, but I don't know. There's really nothing here that feels like a hook for me. A backstory for the Joker is like one of the legendary blunders, right up there with never get involved in a land war in Asia, as far as I'm concerned. So right there, you've got a hard, you know, a really hard fight for me to get involved in this. And the fact that every time I see the trailer, I just have this feeling that we are going to be put in a Travis Bickle situation where I'm going to be asked as a viewer empathize with, you know,
with a horrible person. Right. No.
Right.
And I've always had that problem. In fact, I'll be talking about The Boys here pretty soon. I don't say ugh. But at the same time, I like character studies, and I like when we can have a discussion on maybe he doesn't turn into a bad guy. We don't know. I mean, we know what happens, but to the Joker as a character, but we don't know what's going to happen to this character. And I'm interested to see what their take is on this loner. If this is a reflection on our current society, is this just a send up to Martin Scorsese and Robert De Niro films? You know, what's going on with this thing? I think it's going to be very fascinating. And the other thing is, I know we see this and we see Joker and we are like, ah, DC Comics. Yes, yes, yes. But I went to go see Once Upon a Time in Hollywood this past weekend, and they ran two trailers for movies that are coming out that if you didn't know that they were comic book movies, you would be hard pressed to say, oh yeah, that's based on a comic book, with just some of the stuff that these trailers were shown. I can't remember the two of them off the top of my head, but I'm pretty sure both of them were DC properties.
Was it the Kitchen?
Is that the one with the all-female
like
cast?
Melissa McCarthy.
Yes, The Kitchen. Yes, that's it. That's a DC Comics one that's coming out.
It's a Vertigo book, yeah.
Yeah, and so I'm very interested to see, because, you know, whether we want to raise the villain up to, you know, something that we look up to, which we shouldn't, and I'm not a big fan of that. But I think the interesting thing is that the creators of the film are basically coming out and saying, yeah, no, this is not based on anything in the comic book. which is good, right? Because so many times people complain about horrible adaptations of The Watchmen or The Killing Joke or whatever that may be. But at the same time, I think it's interesting that we can look at a character from comic books or whatever, just pick a character, and we can tell different stories of those characters in different situations, in different genre or different medium or whatever that may be, and tell something different each time. Because, you know, we talk about ancient Greek and Roman gods and the mythologies around those, or Norse gods and the mythology around those. Sure. And those stories change. They're so inconsistent with one another, and there's not really a set continuity, and it's all wacky and
weird.
They
need an editor.
But what's great about it is we can put these characters, whether it be Loki, in these different situations, and actually tell some interesting stories with those characters. So I think that's maybe why I'm very interested in seeing the Joker when it comes out.
I do hope that it is a smash hit, scrapillion dollar success.
I don't think it will be.
I think I want it to be for one reason only.
Why is that?
Because I want the Dude Bros to have to argue over whether or not Heath Ledger's Joker is the be-all and end-all of the character from now to eternity, because then they'll have something else to tell me is the greatest thing they've ever seen. But, there's always the argument of, if it's not based on anything from the comic book, why the hell is it called The Joker?
Yeah.
Why is this a Joker movie and not something else? And that's my biggest question here is, they're spending a lot of time saying, okay, you guys know The Joker. You love The Joker. This is a built-in audience. Everything you know about The Joker is totally not in this movie. So come see it.
Yeah, it's weird. We talked about The Eternals and how Matthew is a liar and has never...
Yeah, no one's ever read The Eternals.
A copy of The Eternals, because it's not a book that actually exists.
Yeah.
Anyway,
it's a proven fact.
We talked about the fact that not a lot of people know about The Eternals. So Marvel movies get to basically construct these characters whole cloth for the movies, taking whatever they want from the comics, discarding whatever they don't, because nobody's going to fight them, because only Matthew has ever heard of these characters, right? It's interesting that they're taking that same thing with a very popular, well-known character. It's right. Like the only character that's more well-known than the Joker is probably Batman. It's like Batman, the Joker, then Superman, then the Penguin, then Wonder Woman, right?
Right.
It's like,
and then Scooby-Doo.
Yeah. So
well, I think what's interesting is, we can see a Batman movie and we've seen Batman's origin a million times, right?
Yeah.
How many origin stories of the Joker have we seen? Batman 89 has an origin story of the Joker.
Thousand.
No, the Killing Joke of the Joker has an origin story. But beyond that, I mean, we really don't have who is this person under the red hood? I mean, who is this person? What is his backstory? How did he get to
Year One have a...
Yeah.
I don't know if
One has one. Gotham has one, right?
Gotham had one. I know that there are several prose adaptations because I've read them, but I don't know if those count.
That go back into the actual who was the Joker before he became the Joker?
Yep.
Yeah.
Talk about his abused childhood and how his favorite doll was a little Harlequin. And one day his abusive dad broke the Harlequin, and that's when his mind broke and he stabbed his father to death to try and save his mother, and flibbity blibbity blue. It's Further Adventures of the Joker. It was a DC trade paperback, probably 15, 20 years ago.
But those are those are not as well known though.
Yeah. They don't stick because it doesn't make sense. The Joker is not,
there
the
are literally three canonical Jokers in comics right now. And that's not even counting the mess that is the Batman Who Laughs.
Yeah, the Joker is fun because you can't get a handle on him, right? Yeah. Because he's so unpredictable. The moment that you give him a backstory, he becomes less interesting. I would argue that the same thing happened to Wolverine, but people will probably argue me down. It's like there's characters that are just more interesting when they just have a nebulous backstory, right? Batman is all about his backstory. That's why every Batman that we see that backstory, because it's the only thing that explains why this crazy person behaves this way.
Right.
It's like with the Joker, when you try to explain it, it doesn't work. It's actually, you know, you talk about Batman and the Joker being two sides of the same coin. I think in this way, it's very much true in that for Batman, you need that origin. For the Joker, you need to not have that origin. As long as you're going to have that comic book Joker that fights Batman and commits, you know, giant theatrical crimes and does all this other stuff, right? Who knows what this Joker is going to be like? This origin story might be just fine because they're going to presumably construct a character that then makes sense based on that origin story.
Yeah.
And they have no pressure, or they feel no pressure, to keep it into any sort of canonical Jokerness.
What I find interesting in this, and again, this is me projecting what could be as opposed to maybe what actually is, but the trailer has a lot of what's his name, the actor, Joaquin Phoenix.
Phoenix,
yeah,
Joaquin Phoenix
doing some
his
voiceover
called
stuff.
Him Leaf when he was a little boy,
doing a lot of voiceover stuff, right?
Mm-hmm.
And we see a lot of time being spent in the Arkham Asylum or, you know, doing something at Arkham.
Yeah. It's like he works there or
yeah.
Something.
Or maybe he's going in for therapy or maybe he's going in for, and
I do like,
I kind of get a vibe. I kind of get the vibe that we're getting a little bit of, the Usual Suspects in this, in that somebody the other day, I forget who it was on Twitter, was like, oh, I'm watching Breaking Bad, and then I'm also watching Better Call Saul. And at this point in the story, you know, Jimmy is not, he's not even close to being the Jimmy that we see in Breaking Bad. Sure. And then I was like, yes, but you do realize that this entire Better Call Saul is all told via flashback from the narrator's perspective.
Yeah.
And the person was like, oh, I didn't realize that. And I'm like, yeah, it's in the very first episode. He finds the videotapes and he's going back and having these flashbacks and memories of what his life was like before he had to go into hiding. And so
maybe
we get into maybe a little fallacy of the storyteller, an unreliable narrator.
It's something that could be in here. Sure.
I mean, we got that in the Nolan Joker movies, right? Where Heath Ledger told his origin story like three different times in the movie and none of them were the exact same.
Oh, sure.
So maybe I think that would be very interesting.
I've blocked those movies out.
What's that?
I don't know. I've blocked those movies out.
Really? Okay.
People have told me for so many ways for so long that they are the perfect movies ever.
I don't know if they're the perfect movies. I think you need to be talking to some different kinds of people.
You need to stop hanging out with Jake.
Yeah.
Jake just keeps telling you all this stuff and it's making you upset, man. Just don't hang out with Jake anymore.
Yeah. Yeah. So I don't know. Listeners, what do you think? Use the comment section over at majorspoilers.com or head over to our Discord server and get to talking in either our movie channel or our comic book channel or our Major Spoilers podcast channel. You can go in there and you can hang out with some like-minded cool folks. There's a link to our Discord server right there in the show notes. Just click on it. It'll open up your Discord app and take you right there. The community is really growing and there's a lot of cool people in there and a lot of cool discussions and a lot of ways that you can level up. I don't know what happens when you hit the top level, but maybe you will open up a dimensional portal and be sucked into another dimension. I don't know. You'll have to go over to our Discord server and find out.
I mean, one can hope.
I know, right? Okay, let's do some reviews.
Reviews.
Okay, a couple of things. I think I'm going to start with The Boys. This is the Amazon original series. I don't know. Have any of you had a chance to watch this yet or any part of it yet?
I haven't. I don't know. I'm kind of hurting for content right now. And I almost started watching it, but then I thought better of it because I remember reading The Boys and not really liking it.
Okay, let me ask you this. What didn't you like about The Boys comic book?
What didn't I like about The Boys comic book? I felt that there was kind of this underlying thing about it where it's not that it was being very gross because that was there, but at times I felt like this comic was being like, see how gross I'm being. I'm doing this for you.
Right.
Like,
so
that's what I feel about The Boys.
Yes. So The Boys comic book is definitely a story that's turned up to 11 or 12 just so that we can say, look at all the grossness that we can put in here. Mm-hmm. The Boys television series, they're dialing that back to like a 9.5 in that. Yes, there are some gross moments. The girlfriend, Wee Huey's girlfriend, she dies exactly like we, well, not exactly. I mean, she does get blown up by getting hit by a superhero. And so, you know, Huey's holding her arms just like you see in the comic book. But and there are a couple of other kind of disturbing moments where people are killed in somewhat disturbing ways. But it's not pushing that gross. Look how far we can push. Look at, you know, we're totally pushing this as hard and as far as we can. There actually seems to be an effort by the creators to sit here and say, okay, what are some of the themes that we want to explore with these characters? And how can we take some of the elements from the Boys comic book and tell kind of the same tale, but tell it differently? And that's what this series is. It's not a direct adaptation of the comic book. And I think we've talked about this before that, you know, hey, if you're doing a direct adaptation of something, why does it even need to be adapted into this form? This is really like the Boys 2.0 or 3.0. If you're thinking about Wildstorm to Dynamite to TV, this is a kind of a reboot of that entire Boys franchise where, yes, you still have a lot of the same characters, but we're learning something very different about each of the characters in this universe. We're learning something different about what it means to be secretive, what it means to be corrupt, what it means to be driven by a desire for revenge. And I was like you, Rodrigo, when I was getting ready to watch this, I was like, oh yeah, the Boys are out. I don't know if I really want to watch this because number one, at the time I was like, it doesn't have Simon Pegg as Wee Huey. And then someone's like, oh no, Simon Pegg's in this show. He's in like four episodes or something like that. He plays Wee Huey's father. And I was like, oh, okay, well, this could be interesting. And then I was like, I wonder if they're going to go full on out like we've saw in the first issue of The Boys, where Wee Huey's girlfriend gets blowed up real good. And I wonder if it's going to be as depraved in many instances as we saw in the comic books with sex orgies and all this stuff. And they really go in a different direction where you do have these group of people led by Billy Butcher, who is played by Carl Urban. Again, Carl Urban can play any role. And you're like, where do I know that guy from? Oh, yeah, from Star Trek. Oh, where do I know that guy from? Oh, yeah, Judge Dredd. Oh, where do I know that guy from? Good. He's really, really
Thor
good.
Thor Ragnarok.
This. Yeah. Yeah. Where do I know him from? Yeah, he's in Thor Ragnarok. He's just really, really good as Billy Butcher. As I said, Simon Pegg plays Wee Huey's father. The one that I think is the scariest character in this entire thing. Oh, Elizabeth Shue is in this, Matthew, and she looks good. And she plays this corporate VP that controls all of the Seven. And she is just devious and she is just manipulative. And she is, you just see corporate greed and corporate corruption all throughout the Seven as heroes. But the actor that I think brings the best performance in this series is Anthony Starr, who plays Homelander, because he is able to like instantly switch from someone who is super, super likable to where it's like, oh yeah, this guy is super great. And the acting is so good and the directing is so good that as an audience member, you start to get drawn into, oh yeah, this is a really nice guy. This guy is really super. And then instantly he just turns to villain. And it's not like the mustache twirling villain, although there is a big aspect of that. But just all of a sudden he goes from, hey, I'm a super likable guy, to what the bleep and bleep is this here for? And you can just really see the evil, the corruption of Homelander in here. And it is, I was really surprised. It is really good. There is, of course, as we see in a lot of modern media, we see a lot of commentary about what is currently going on in the social, political, and religious aspects of the world, especially when it comes to Annie January. Starlight, played by Erin Moriarty. We see a lot of commentary about that. and her character and her character arc. And we even see we go through a much different arc. And it's 8 episodes. It's 8 hours. I didn't intend to watch all of the episodes in one weekend, but I wanted to watch like one episode and kind of get a feel for it Friday before finally Friday last week. And by Sunday afternoon, I had finished all of the episodes because I was like, oh, I want to see what happens next because I don't remember any of this stuff from the comics. And sure enough, none of this is in the comics.
How many episodes is it?
It's only 8 episodes, but they're a long 8 hours.
Yeah.
Not that it feels long, but you know how sometimes you get Stranger Things is kind of bad on this, where sometimes you get a 42-minute episode and sometimes you get a 58-minute episode. These are consistently an hour long and they move very quickly. And by the end of it, you're like, wow, what are they going to do next? How are they going to do this next? The special effects in this show are a heck of a lot better than the Powers show that I complained so much about back in the day. The effects in this are much, much better than what you see in The Flash or any of the CW shows that I complain about all the time. They put some money behind this. And I guess if I were to say, what is the theme of this entire first season is just lies and hypocrisy is what goes on in this. And it's very, very well done. I was taken by a lot of times just by looking at the cinematography of how are they composing these shots? How are they lighting this? What colors are they using? How do they play on these themes and ideas? I literally went in with very low expectations, Matthew, and came out going, oh, this is better than the comic book, in my opinion. This series is better than the comic book because it is not everything that turned Rodrigo off or turned me off on the comic book series. So I'm giving this 4.5 slices of meatloaf out of 5. I would encourage people to at least watch the first episode for the setup. And I would certainly encourage you to go at least 3 episodes in before it just kind of like when you're reading a comic book, I'll read the first 2 or 3 issues and then decide. If you go 3 episodes into this and you're like, yeah, this is still not doing it for me, then by all means back out. But the end, I mean, this definitely has a cliffhanger. There's a bunch of stuff that's not resolved at the end of this series. You know that I believe they're already in production, already shooting season 2 right now. It's going on between now and November. I'm really interested to see where this story goes next because this is not covering everything that we had seen in the comic books. Now, there are certain themes, for example, just a little bit of a spoiler, Compound V, which was kind of a thing in the comic book.
Yeah.
Is the main central MacGuffin, but that is then revealed to have a big impact in this superhero universe and how superheroes act and do things. And I don't want to give any more spoilers away on that. But then to see how the characters react to this information and use this information is just amazing. And there's stuff that, Was there a character in the comic books called the Deep?
Yeah.
Okay.
Their Aquaman equivalent.
Yeah, he's the Aquaman here, but he's like a complete just loser tool.
Yeah, he was in the comics.
And there is a moment in this show where he gets it in his mind that he is going to go rescue a dolphin from a water park and go free it in the ocean. And it just goes disastrously wrong in so many ways that I would say don't drink anything while you're watching that scene because you'll be spitting it out all over your TV or all over your computer in just, oh my God, I cannot believe they did that kind of moments. And there's a couple of those where it's like, oh my God, I cannot believe they did that. There's a part where Butcher actually weaponizes a newborn baby in a way that is just like, oh my God, I can't believe they did that. So, there's some shocking moments, but I don't think, Rodrigo, it is the big turnoff that the comic book was.
Okay.
So I would say, definitely watch the first episode. Give the first 3 a chance. And then after that, if you want to see what happens after that, then by all means, just watch the rest of the series. It is our rate. I would say it's got a mature rating because depending on the episode, obviously there's going to be a lot of violence. There are body parts that get blown up. People get blown up. Things get blown up. But there's also a lot of, and this is probably the bigger trigger for a lot of people, there's a lot of sex. And not over-the-top sex, but there's sex and nude parts and stuff that people will have, I'm sure, some issue with, but I don't. But it's still very good, but probably not something you want your kids to watch if you haven't had the big sex talk with them. So there you go. That is The Boys. It's out now on as part of your Amazon Prime membership on Amazon Video. I enjoyed it. So there you go. Rodrigo, out last week, though, was something from the Nintendo's, a new video game.
A new video game.
On the Switch.
Yep. Fire Emblem Three Houses. So Fire Emblem Three Houses is surprising already because it is actually getting a really good reception and it's selling a good amount of copies, which is rare for the Fire Emblem series in the United States. It's just not as popular a game. I mean, it's a Nintendo property and it's nowhere near as popular as, you know, Mario or Zelda or any of the, or, you know, Metroid. But people are really kind of getting into it. And it, I think a big part of it is a pretty successful campaign to advertisement campaign to get you into it, because the crux of the game, it comes from a choice. It's set, at least the early part of it is set in a military academy for nobles. And this is like a medieval fantasy type setting. And you become a professor, or your character avatar becomes a professor in this place, and you have to pick one of the three houses, hence Fire Emblem Three Houses, to guide the Black Eagles, the Blue Lions, and the Golden Deer. And, you know, people are like super into that. Each house that you pick gives you, basically comes with eight students, all of whom are training to be warriors, all of whom are have been accepted to this very prestigious academy for one reason or another, generally because they're nobles. And you kind of get to pick which group of teenagers you want to start leading into battle, which is weird. It's a weird way to like approach a game, but it's very interesting. They've done a lot of work on all of their personalities. There's tons of interactions that you can have. There's tons of interactions that you can see them have with each other, even across houses. So when you think about, you know, eight people per house times three houses plus school staff, like professors and kitchen staff and stuff, is like there's actually a lot of story to be had here. And that's kind of what's very different about Fire Emblem Three Houses from other Fire Emblem games, if you've ever played them, is that in other Fire Emblem games, you basically go from fight to fight to fight to fight, and you have these moments in the middle where you kind of like get your gear and like swap things out and move people in and out of the party and have a little bit of story in between, or have some story in between the fights. But in this, they have changed it. They allow you to sort of move freely around a fairly large area and talk to characters and have characters talk to each other and develop a lot of the story that way through conversation and through kind of natural conversation, whereas other Fire Emblem games, it was a lot of like war reports. Like your character would be there and somebody would come in and be like, Commander, somebody, like, there's brigands over here. And you'd have to be like, oh, well, we have to get those brigands. Those brigands turn out they have like a magic skull, you guys. And it's like, okay, well, we have to watch that. It's like in this, you know, the magic skull kind of comes up a lot more organically. It's easy to get bogged down in all the talking and not do a lot of fighting. And the game doesn't always incentivize fighting, which is interesting since it's, you know, supposed to be a tactical war game, basically. And there are times when you can just decide just to not have a fight. You can just be like, no, I'm going to have this fight later, or I'm just not going to do it. And the game's okay with it. There are certain fights that you have to do. But a lot of the time there are fights that you can just skip or that are optional, which is interesting. I'm having a lot of fun with it. I am one of the things that you can do is you can try to recruit people from other houses into your house. And I'm just having a very difficult time doing that because everybody wants different things. And I feel like I'm just not a very good professor because I spend a lot of time chasing after this healer girl and people are going to start to talk.
Yeah, you got to watch out for that.
Yeah, because I really want her in my... But she's cute, though. Like all the characters are cute because they're all like teenager anime babies. You know what I'm talking about?
Yeah.
It's like they all have like giant eyes and it's like seriously just like Google Fire Emblem Three Houses. Like you're going to see the picture of three characters. Those are like the heads of each of the houses.
And all I see is porn.
All right. Turn Safe Search on, then put in Fire Emblem Three Houses.
Okay, hang on. Oh, yeah, they are cute.
Yeah. So it's, you know, it's good times. Again, for the real Fire Emblem diehards, what's really nice about this is that these first eight characters that you get are very malleable. So you can customize them in ways that you really couldn't with other Fire Emblem games. Usually somebody shows up and they're like, hey, I'm already a fighter. But in this game, you can really do a lot of customization where a character comes up and is like, I'm kind of good at using a spear. And you can be like, well, here's a magic book. You're a wizard now. And they're like, all right, fine. Speaking of you're a wizard now, people make the comparison to Harry Potter. They're like, oh, it's like playing a video game where it's Hogwarts. And there's something to that because, you know, there is magic and it's like medieval and it's a school. But especially I think the way that things kind of move forward, maybe a more apt comparison is Ender's Game. So take that as you will.
That's somewhat disturbing.
Yeah. So, which again, you know, it's like, it's, you know, that's kind of how the story starts moving forward. Don't read too much into that. Just take that totally.
Okay. Okay.
So I'm going to give it 4 slices of meatloaf. There are things about it that aren't jiving perfectly with me, but This game is already a lot of fun. I'm already kind of very attached to my characters. And like with all Fire Emblem games, you know, if you fight them and they die forever. You can it so that doesn't happen. I think I did that at the beginning, but I also haven't lost anybody yet. So I don't remember. And I'm very tense about it. But yeah, 4 slices of meatloaf. I'm really enjoying it. It's the first thing that has happened anytime recently to get me away from Mortal Kombat 11.
Awesome. Very cool. All right, Matthew, let us actually talk about a comic book. Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles as we march towards episode or issue 100. And we get the new female turtle in the group. Let us know what's going on.
So the Foot Clan.
Mm-hmm.
Which has been this evil thorn in the side of the turtles forever, is now under the control of Splinter, who is their rat daddy. And Rat Daddy has managed to maneuver the Foot Clan into war with the Shredder's daughter. And honestly, that's nothing new. Karai is a character who's been around for a while. I think she was the villain of the big TMNT movie a few years ago that had Buffy the Vampire Slayer. But this issue is interesting because it's all really big buildup. This is part 4 of the City at War storyline. And we end up seeing the turtles all split up across the city. So Donatello is somehow being blackmailed into doing some things for some people who are not very good. And Michelangelo is off doing something else. And Leonardo is unconscious because in order to save the life of Casey Jones's girlfriend, he gave her a blood transfusion, which is to say a transfusion of the ooze. Which is exactly how Casey Jones's girlfriend, Jenica, wakes up at the beginning of this issue as a mutant turtle. Or at least a mutant. It's unclear whether she has a shell, but she's definitely green and lumpy, and she has 2 fingers. And so, dealing with the fallout from that, because again, Casey's girlfriend got turned into a turtle. He's not sure about it. Kairu is running around trying to take over the city and, in fact, murdering crime bosses, which I think is lovely. The thing that I really appreciate about IDW's Turtles continuity is it is essentially based on the original Mirage continuity. And the reason that I say that is good is because Baxter Stockman is in this. He's not a crazy fly guy. He's actually
an amoral jerk who's running for mayor. And once again, we see, you know, parallels to people who crave political power just for their own aggrandizement throughout this. He's actually working with a secret underground army of mutants. And it's more than just turtle mutants. We see bear mutants and hawk mutants, and there's a really evil one-eyed cat running around who I think appeared out of a Black Sad issue. But after all of this comes
down...
Old
Hob is who you're talking about, right?
Yeah, that's clearly what it is. Yeah, it's Fire Lord Ozai, only he's a cat. But nonetheless, as this issue comes to an end, the turtles are starting to come back together, and Splinter is like overconfident. And Karai shows up to kill him, and he's like, would you like some tea? Which is a beautiful Splinter moment. And the issue ends with something I've never seen before. Splinter is doing his beautiful Splinter moment where he is, you know, the head of the Foot Clan now, and you can't outthink him, and you can't outmaneuver him. And she did. And she does. And she explains to him that for years she's studied the history of the Foot Clan and its weaknesses, and right now its weakness is his own rage. And the issue ends with Cairo not having just showing up to mess with people or to fight them or to, you know, attack his turtle babies, but bringing an entire army of mutants and ninjas and teenagers, I presume. I don't know. We're going to go for everything. And getting ready to kill everybody and take over the city. And it's a really shocking ending. And I haven't read a Turtles book since the mid-80s. The mid-80s of this series, not the mid-1980s. That would be also a time when I read Turtles books, but not this time. But I really enjoyed this issue. The weakness that I have with it is, you know, part four of a 10-part story is always going to be a little bit confusing. There are things in here that I don't get, things that I don't like. But I do appreciate the fact that after, what, 25 years of denying that there was ever a fifth female turtle, Kevin Eastman is now introducing a canonical fifth female turtle, and it's clearly with the intention that this time we're doing it right. So I'm kind of on board for that, simply because I feel like we really need somebody with a yellow bandana just to balance out the colors of the group. And that is why Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, or TMNT, depending on how it's titled, number 96 is 3.5 slices of meatloaf for me. It's a beautiful book. It's really well drawn. It's very clear. I love the coloring. I like the art. I like the fact that Jenny, being a human who turned into a turtle mutant, doesn't look exactly like the boys because they're turtles who turned into humans. She's a human who turned into a turtle. And so she is a similar but not identical mutant. And I'm totally down with that. And don't trust anybody who mocks the idea of a fifth turtle. They've done it like 7, 8, 10 times. And it's always interesting until they retcon it away and never speak of it again.
You know how they keep restarting the Ninja Turtles? Like every 5 to 6 years, they make a new cartoon or they try a new movie or whatever. I think the next one, they should really just have all like 9 turtles in it. Right? Yeah. They should have, like, obviously the original four, mm-hmm. and what was this girl's name? Jenny?
Jenny, Venus
de Milo.
You get Slash in there.
Yeah, Slash. Yeah, exactly. Just throw Razor in there. Or wait, was it Toko or Razor? Whichever one.
The one that was played by Kevin Nash. I don't know.
It's like whichever one the big snapper was is like, yeah, they're just all of them in there from the beginning, and then you just go from there.
I want to say there was another female turtle, like maybe Roxy, if I'm not mistaken.
Probably.
But I may be crazy.
No, I think you're right. I want to say even in the IDW stuff, there was another, or like at least talk of another female turtle. I might be confusing it with something else, though.
It happens.
Yeah. All right. Thank you for that, Matthew and listeners. If you want to check out even more reviews, make sure you head over to majorspoilers.com, where we have new stuff popping up every single day of the week. Every single day, there's something new to read at majorspoilers.com. And there's plenty of podcasts for you to listen to over at Apple Podcasts. Also, you can find them at majorspoilers.com. That's our central repository for all that stuff. But if you're looking for stuff that talks about games, if you're looking for shows that that provide that listicle need that you desire so much. If you're looking for insight or funny bits, if you're looking for real play podcasts, we got it all over at majorspoilers.com. So what are you waiting for? Go check out some of our other shows. I know that a lot of people are not aware that we do, on average, 7 shows a week for your entertainment. And I think there's something for everyone. Just go check it out. It's the Major Spoilers Podcast Network. Okay. We are going to talk about the Justice Society and their return. This all came out of, this is all out of Zero Hour, Matthew.
Sort of, kind of. This is a few years after Zero Hour. The thing that you run into with the Justice Society is that they keep being declared too old and written out of continuity. So in 86, they're like, they're too old. World War II heroes, we're writing them out. And then 91, they're like, oh, wait, no, they're back. And then Zero Hour was 94, and Zero Hour is like, nope, they're too old, they're out of continuity. And then this is 1999, so most of them have been out of play for about 4 or 5 years at this point. And they're like, oh, well, maybe they're not too old after all.
Yeah, and let's reintroduce them by telling a story set in World War II, and we introduce Sergeant Slaughter into the universe. I'm sorry, a god named Stalker, who figures out that the only way to prevent war is to kill everybody, because if you don't have any living beings, then they can't fight each other, and he will get his soul back. And so through 2 all-star issues and then individual team-up issues,
right,
we get to
all-star
see...
All-star number one, and then like,
yeah,
6
all-star number two
team-up issues, and then all-star number two, mm-hmm, is the closure.
And we get to see the various heroes teaming up and doing various World War II things, addressing things like the Spear of Destiny and how that was keeping the heroes out of Europe during World War II. We get to see people fighting in, we get to see, what is it, the Versailles meeting, where they go in and they save, right, Stalin and Roosevelt and a bunch of other national leaders, international leaders, from being killed. And, you know, you pick your World War II genre, your World War II battle or moment, and I'm sure in one of these, what is it, 5 issues, 4 issues?
I think it's 6 individuals.
Oh, 6 individual team-ups?
Yeah.
Then that's going on. So it's all right there for you. What'd you guys think? Rodrigo, what'd you think of the Justice Society Returns?
Well,
I think, that's very telling.
Yeah, so I think it just, it really comes on like gangbusters, like, mm-hmm, just out of the gate is like, our man is like going in and kicking stuff, and then the bad guy's on and is like, and now we're running across the world and the Third Reich, and here we go. And it's very interesting because other than a very sort of a very kind of dry like introduction page, like this is who all these characters are, mm-hmm, there's like no build up to who these characters are and why they're important. So if you're like, oh, I've always wanted to pick up to learn about the Justice Society, you're just gonna be like, who are all these people, like what is this happening, it's like, do they already know each other, are they friends, is this a thing, where are they returning from?
Yeah, and if you're worried about, oh, I'm not going to know who any of these characters are, the first like couple of pages of All-Star number one is, I'm our man, and here's the pill that I invented, and here's my powers, and then suddenly I go up against these cult members. I'm like, yeah, this is all kind of cool, very interesting, very cool. And then something bad happens, and we have to go back to the JSA headquarters, and then we get a 2-page spread where we literally introduce everyone and their powers. So yeah, you'll get a JSA roll call type moment in this book that will kind of give you an idea who they are. And that's then, of true, course, I think the problem is, and I think you're kind of touching on this, Rodrigo, is who are these guys? Why are they important? It's because most readers would not have a personal connection to the Atom or to Dr. Midnight or to any of these other guys. And so when you get into this very big thing of, oh, yes, I have invulnerability to nuclear radiation because of all these things. And you're like, oh, that's great. But you're just kind of like, I don't have an emotional connection to your backstory or your origin, yeah, story or your moment of crisis that you're having in this particular issue. And I think that's just the nature of time that's and distance from the characters.
I think that's really what it is that I feel like you can write a Superman story that has that similar kind of disconnect and just assume that people are going to fill in the blanks. But when you write an Hourman story or a Dr. Midnight story, you can't expect that. And you can tell people these are the powers that these guys have and this is their backstory, but you have to do more to build that connection, their relationships, their relationships to each other, which I think I feel like this book doesn't start with. I think by the end of it, you have it, but it makes it kind of difficult to penetrate, especially because also there's so many of them.
Right, yeah. Right. And to be fair, Matthew, some of these characters are back in comics at the time. I mean, there is a Sandman comic going on over at Vertigo, I think, right at this time.
Sandman Mystery Theater would have been roughly contiguous or ended just before. I know the Golden Age limited series, which I'm pretty sure we discussed many years ago.
Starman is going on at this time.
About 2 or 3 years before this. Starman has his own book, yeah.
I know that Hourman had a deal going on, I think, during Zero Hour a few years before. And of course, you have Wonder Woman and the Hawks and you have Jay Garrick. People may not know who Dr. Midnight is, but certainly Alan Scott has shown up in previous books. So some of these people are scattered around, especially Wildcat going on over at Catwoman at the time. So I think that there is some of that going on, but what are your thoughts before we go into the big heady discussions, Matthew? Let's get your thoughts so we're not locking you out here. It's okay to say you liked it.
Well, this is the thing. I don't. I appreciate lots of this, but this is the most David S. Goyer book of any David S. Goyer book you've ever read. And the reason for that is that there is literally nothing new in these pages. This is stitching together everything that we already know about these characters. In fact, the Stalker, the main villain, is actually an existing DC character. He had his own book back in 77. Mm-hmm. He's a Steve Ditko creation. All of the villains are stitched together out of other things. There's a point at the beginning where the heroes show up and all of a sudden, oh my God, who are these new guys? It's Merlin and Tor. They're both quality comics heroes who were created as knockoffs of Zatara. They had not been a part of DC Universe before that, and they aren't afterwards. And literally the only reason they're here is so that he can stitch together these knockoffs as, oh, yes, they're all from the same magical order.
Yeah, but also, too, we have to keep in mind that this isn't just David S. Goyer, who you all know from such movies as Blade and Blade 2 and Blade Trinity and Batman Begins and Blade the Series and Batman Gotham Knights and The Dark Knight. And let's see, what else do we have here? Constantine, Matthew, the TV series. So people know who David S. Goyer is. But, you know, a lot of these individual issues, Mark Waid is in here. Jeff Johns is in here. And to be honest, the Jeff Johns issue is the worst of the series.
James Robinson is
in here. So you do have a variety of different writers who are doing this. But I think and I'm not going to try to put words in your mouth, but what I'm getting from you is also kind of a feeling that I got while I was reading this was, there was not a, for lack of a better term, a showrunner for this entire series. And it's like, you, Mark Waid, go take a Flash and go take this other guy. And you guys go have a story that takes place in Germany. And by the end, they have to defeat the big bad and then they come back. That's all that you have to do. It doesn't feel like there was any kind of overall story showrunner who was overseeing all the aspects of the stories to making sure that there is some continuity going on between the different issues. In fact, every issue ends essentially the same way, but very different not Dr. Fate, Dr. Occult coming through and saying, oh yes, you've completed your mission. Now come with me. That should have been the exact same thing at the end of every issue so that people knew that it was all taking place at the same time. And so I think that's kind of where the series falls apart, is that there's not an overall sense of that this is one story. This all feels like, there's some bookend stuff and a bunch of other things, and we don't care.
Well, part of it is that they are trying to make people, you know, readers of 1999, more familiar with each of the Justice Society members at a time when Marvel and DC weren't just saying, just throwing up their hands and going, F it, there's five Flashes and three Spider-Men. We weren't at that point yet. So part
we
of that
certainly
is
were
here,
with the Flashes with Mark Waid in 99.
No, not quite yet.
Yes, but
we
at this point,
two Flashes in play.
Oh no, we had Max Mercury was going on by 99.
Max Mercury's not a Flash.
He's a speedster.
He's a Quicksilver.
He's a speedster.
He's
a. In fact, in that Flash issue, they made a point of showing every freaking speedster that Mark Waid had any kind of a creation on.
He's a thing, but this is the thing. When you get right down to it, this book is structurally, I think, a story that happens because we want to do X, Y, and Z by the end of this story. So this nine-issue series exists to mechanically do all the housekeeping to get people into play where we want them. And the biggest problem with that is when you have the Justice Society, you have to deal with the fact that two of them, there are seven or eight main Justice Society members. Four have no powers.
Yeah.
One has no powers and wings. One has a magic ring, and two of them are cosmic forces that will melt your very face. So we have to have the metaphorical Billy Batson gag in play to keep him from saying Shazam. And literally half of the first issue is they're designed solely to come up with a MacGuffin big enough to take Dr. Fate and the Spectre off the field of play so that the remaining heroes have something to do. That's the problem, I think, with this whole thing is it's reverse engineered. It's a story that says, here's where we want to end up.
Yeah.
This is a book that exists because we want to end up here and establish that this new Justice Society that we see on the very last page of All-Star number two with the Black Canaries and the Starmans and the young Star-Spangled Kids and someone who is apparently a crazy sporting goods salesman wearing a faceplate. I don't know what that's all about. Actually, I do. I'm just pretending I don't. But you get to the end of this and you realize that this is created to move the pieces into play so that the Justice Society series that launches immediately after this has everybody in place and you have an idea of who everybody is. And from a marketing standpoint, that's not bad. I mean,
no,
from
it's,
the standpoint
it's not.
Of an editor, that's not bad. It's just not fun to read.
I think one of the things that this feels like structurally is they are attempting to do they're attempting to do kind of a Crisis on Infinite Earths where here's this guy that shows up, this guy with these great cosmic powers that threatens to destroy all of reality. And then we have to go take care of, instead of in the crisis where we have to go take care of these sonic keys or these sonic pillars, we have to go and take care of these five horsemen of the apocalypse or six horsemen of the apocalypse or whatever that they are. And then we have to go up and then we have to go and team up to take them down. And it just, I don't know. It works as far as team ups go. And you do, I mean, it's, as you said, Matthew, from a marketing standpoint, it works. From a thematic way, it works. It's just, I wish there was some better continuity between issues because honestly, if you just read All-Star 1 and All-Star 2, you don't have to read anything else.
Yeah, and I think part of that is the fact that each one of these one-shots, first of all, is a number one. So if you're going to read them, there's no real order, canonically speaking, that you have to read them in.
Right.
They're all kind of taking place as a free-for-all. They are the equivalent of Vince McMahon's 30-man Royal Rumble to get everybody on the payroll for the big pay-per-view. So that everybody gets their paycheck and gets the take home from WrestleMania. And you can't hate that. You can't be arguing, you know, that shouldn't happen because all these guys deserve their chance. All of these characters, all these creators deserve a chance to say something with the Justice Society. And I think all of the JSA players and even, you know, the 15 or 16 guest stars that show up because we get a bunch of guys.
Yeah, we get. It's like every one of these like team up issues, maybe not every one of them, but a lot of them have all of these like extra guys that then show up to help.
Yep, the Star Spangled Kid and Stripesy show up. The Tigress is in this. Manhunter. King Standish is in this. Speed Saunders, who is a super minor DC character, not only shows up, but gets retconned in as Hawk Girl's cousin, which I think is hysterical because her last name was Sanders. But again, David Goyer, no research required. And we put this all together. And on the one hand, it really is interesting world building, kind of putting everything together and saying, you know, all those crazy comics that you used to love, they all fit together like this. And that's wonderful. Some of the best comics I've ever read do that. Some of the most transcendent comic reading experiences you will ever have are all about, do you remember when X happened? Actually, behind the scenes, there was Y and Z. Sure. That's not necessarily the kiss of death. It's just these are very different tonally, and they all seem to be wanting to say something different about an era or a place or a time or something that happened in World War II. And aside from, you know, hey, Russ Heath got a good paycheck off of this thing, some of these issues, Stephen is right. I'm just, why is this here? Why are we being asked to read this? What does this add to the story?
I also wonder if you go and look at the individual issues, and I don't have the book open here in front of me, but what were the individual issue titles, the team-up stories? Because weren't these actual titles of old DC Golden Age team-ups?
And they all were. There was an Adventure mm-hmm. Comics, All-American Comics, National Comics, which was actually a quality book, Smash Comics, also a quality book, Sensation Comics, Star Spangled Comics, Thrilling Comics, and then the All-Star Wraparound. So there were actually 9 issues rather than 8.
Right. So part of me wonders if, yes, some of this is, hey, you know, all the Golden Age stuff is popular again. Kingdom Come was really great, and people are interested in some of these backstories of some of these characters. We've got these series going on over at Vertigo and other places. Now's a good time to bring this in. But part of me is also like, oh, yeah, copyright. Hey, let's bring back this book called National Periodical or whatever it may be so we can keep that name alive, and we need a reason to do that. That's part of me kind of feels that way in reading some of this, is that the only reason we're doing this is because we have to have a gimmick to keep this alive for another 75 years.
And I mean, based on what we see, and you know, as I said about my concerns with the plotting, I think that's legit. I think that the workings of things were a little, especially 20 years down the road in retrospect, are a little too visible. You know, the expectation mm-hmm. of, oh, well, we're going to put these people in play and we're going to reference this and we're going to talk about this and we're going to, oh, remember how the Atom suddenly had super strength? Well, here he got nuked, and that's totally why his super strength triggers in 1945. You know, it's kind of what Roy Thomas was famous for doing in All-Star Squadron when he was building this, you know, this huge mythology around all the stories that already existed. But it's also done in a way that isn't as enthusiastic, I think, is probably the word.
I mean, again, as I'm thinking about some of the individual issues, I feel like there is some enthusiasm in the characters. And there seems to be some kind of, at least in a couple of the individual standalone team-up issues, there seems to be some motivations from the creators to want to tell a good story. And I'm not saying that all the stories are bad, but it's basically, hey, two people have to come up with some struggles. We learn some little bit of their backstory. They figure out a way to defeat this big giant thing, the end, and then repeat, wash, rinse, repeat for each one. So I'm not sure that that you can say that there's not enthusiasm behind this. Like, each of the writers was just like, oh God, I'm going to do this. I don't think that that's the case.
Not a lot of places to go with it, though.
No, but like I said a couple of weeks ago on the Dueling Review, maybe even last week on Dueling Review podcast, a lot of this is just bad editing in that the editor should be sitting there, or story producer should be sitting there and going, okay, what needs to happen in this to make sure that people buy each of these individual issues? Because this isn't the first series that DC did like this, where you have a bookended story that's one title And then everything right. in between is labeled something else to where you don't know what you need and what you don't need. In fact, a lot of the annual events that were going on, the Bloodlines, the Zero Hour, a lot of that stuff, unless you were paying attention to the trade dress, you didn't know what was going on. And most of those didn't really need to be read in order to understand what was going on in the main story. So again, I think you could read All-Star 1 and All-Star 2, and that's all you need.
Not that long ago, we did JSA World Without Grownups, which is the same model. First issue, then a bunch of individual issues, and then a closer that kind of wraps the whole thing up. And I feel like if you look at this, everything about it should work better than it does.
Right.
Even the choices of team-ups. I mean, Hawkman and Wildcat. It's a cat and a bird. That makes perfect sense. Yeah. The Sandman and the Star-Spangled Kid, who, by the way, is not a JSA member yet, but is being set up to eventually have been a JSA member later. That makes perfect sense. They are both, you know, the guys who run around and do their thing. Wonder Woman and Hawkgirl are the only female heroes in existence. You have the moments that you're like, okay, I can see the brains behind this. Flash and Mr. Terrific. The Flash accidentally murdered Mr. Terrific in 1979. Google it. That's true.
I think it was Flash and Johnny Thunder, wasn't
yes,
it?
Yes.
No, it was Green Lantern and Johnny Thunder.
Oh, that's right. That's right. That's right.
Flash and Mr. Terrific, because Mr. Terrific freaked out at seeing what was kind of what's happening in what's the town that kept getting bombed?
Dresden.
And insisted that Flash run him back to Allied headquarters so he could give somebody a dressing down. So, you know, that's cool. I appreciate that. And, you know, honestly, if nothing else, this story gave us the sight of Dr. Midnight's owl hopped up on goofballs.
Yeah.
Oh, man.
Ah, that right there, I think, is an example of the things in this book that do work don't necessarily work sequentially or tie together sequentially.
Yeah, thematically, they don't really make much sense together.
Yeah, because you go from that Mr. Terrific story where he's like dressing down an Allied general and threatening to punch, you know, this guy in the face, and then we cut immediately to these quiet, almost jokes about our man's addiction to Miraclo and the owl, the super-powered crazy owl. Yeah, that is kind of a wacky moment for me that I love it. I'd like to have more of it in here, but it also doesn't fit with the story being told. And also the owl's name is Hootie.
Also, yeah. some of the deaths are, I don't want to say disturbing in how they take out the big bads, but at one point the Flash throws his helmet and vibrates through the head of the bad guy. And yeah, they kind of explain it away as, oh yes, he had a super bad migraine, Rodrigo. But on the other hand, you're like, oh no, you liquefied that guy's brain.
Yeah.
And so there's some weird stuff there too. That's just like, oh my gosh.
Tonally, this book is very weird because it's like, it really seems to be trying to take these characters that come from the like literal four color world of comics, and tries to kind of turn up the grit, but changes nothing about them, as far as I can tell. It's like Starman still has a fin coming out of his head. Yeah. These guys still look like old school superheroes. Mr. Terrific is just a guy wearing a sweater that says fair play on it.
Mm-hmm.
Like, there's, you know what I'm saying? It's like they...
Oh, no, they're certainly wrapped up in there.
They do not appear to be characters that live in a world where... like thousands of people die of radiation burns before they ever show up to the battlefield. Right. It's like, it's very dissonant.
But at the same time, the way that they
talk and the way that they interact with each other also doesn't lead you to that. So whenever something hyper violent happens, it's like really weird.
Yeah. But at the same time, I think they're also trying to be reverent to the characters, right? Where they're trying to say, this is the way these characters were in this time. And now they're confronting something that is horrific that they've never had to confront before because it's been, you know, 30 years since the last war or however many years since the last war. And these heroes have not had to deal with this stuff. So they are, I guess, dealing with it for the first time. But I just I see where you're coming from. And there's not an attempt to. Modernize them enough.
It's not even, I think, a question of modernizing. I think what it really comes down to, and I reviewed a comic recently and I haven't actually refreshed the review, so I'm not going to tell you the name of the book. But it does, it made me think about something very important about comics, which is to say, if you have these characters existing in a comic book rules and logic apply, even if you say they don't. So even if you go into this with the expectation of, we are defying everything that you know about comics, you know, this is going to be something that completely undermines all of the tropes and tricks and things that you know. And by the way, this is not that. But even if you went in with that, you can't really justify how these stories play out as any coherent, continuing timeline. Because the ending of that Starman Adam story is flat out tragedy. It is messed up. I remember being bugged by this in 1999 and going, holy crap, how are you taking these guys in tights and putting them in this story and not realizing that having the guys in tights in this story, first of all, kind of makes the guys in tights feel completely, you know, meaningless. It takes the concept and minimizes it. But more importantly, it feels like it's minimizing the real world aspect of it. When you're talking about, you know, oh, well, Starman helped to create the atomic bomb, and that's why he has this guilt. That's one thing. They did that in the Golden Age, and that is one thing. But when you have an atomic bomb go off, and the only aftermath is Starman and the Atom going, huh, how'd you survive that, the Atom? It feels like you're minimizing or almost, you know, just degrading the actual things that happened.
That's as you said, that was what was going on at the actual time. I mean, the reason why in the Golden Age during World War II that Superman and the heroes couldn't go to Europe is because Hitler had the Spear of Destiny or whatever it was that was keeping them out of Europe. What's that?
That's so dumb.
It is. And if you're talking about downplaying stuff, even at the time, respect paid to what was going on and the loss of life and the tragedies and the real world stuff that was going on at the time, because you had to hand wave it away.
Yeah, I mean, if you're talking about the actual comics of the time during World War II, it was a combination of, honestly, propaganda and escapism, right? So nothing there is accurate. The issue is that these comics were done like 40 years later or however long later, and don't seem to have, it's like they picked all the bad things, right? It's like, oh, we should be respectful of what happened and depict this loss of life, but here's the Atom who looks like the Atom. He
right,
you know, he's like a little guy wearing a wrestler mask.
Yeah, he also has a little fin on his head.
Yeah, and eventually he levels up and gets a fin on his head. And it's like, yeah, man, it's like, you show me these guys, like everybody, nobody else is wearing a superhero costume except for the JSA and the bad guys. It's like, you got soldiers running around in like, you know, and like their fatigues, and you've got like world leaders and like suits and ties, and these guys look ridiculous compared to them. We talked about The Boys earlier. The Boys does a really good job of being like, see these superheroes, they are terrible. Like, it gets you into that world and into that mindset of, you know, things aren't what they seem. Superheroes bad, guys in leather jackets good. Like, it takes you there. It holds your hand and it takes you there. And this book is just trying to kind of sloppily make that leap to be like, superhero serious, you guys. But they still look like, you know, they still look like dudes wearing pajamas.
Right.
And they're still trying to like maintain the old origins, the old ideas of them, but move them into a modern context. And you can't. Like, either you have to maintain that sort of like four color, like nothing's actually bad morality, or you have to update something else about them. You can't, like, moving them into a world that's like scary and dangerous just makes them look stupid.
Yeah. The one thing that I think that they did really
make a good decision of. And then I was worried about when this book came out. And I was reading comics when the original issues came out. I was actually working in a comic store when the original issues came out. And a lot of the response to this was, why isn't this as good as the Golden Age?
Sure.
And part of it is because they do try to lean into reality and real world things, but they don't necessarily lean into real world emotions and actual responses the way that the Golden Age does.
Yeah.
So I'm glad that while they do talk about the bombing at Dresden, while they do talk about these things, we don't have a shot of, you know, Wonder Woman ending up at Dachau. You don't have the things where they go way over the top and try to, you know, have Batman personally snap the neck of Archduke Ferdinand, whatever it is you have to do. I'm not good at history. So, I mean, the restraint is there and it works up to a point. I'm just, again, it feels like they knew where they wanted to be. They had some characters they wanted to play with and they went, hey, let's just build this backwards. And what it really came together as was the equivalent of, you know, your Lego house when you run out of bricks.
Yeah.
And you got like half a Batmobile in there.
I think there's some good moments in this. Definitely. I like, you know, kind of the issue where everybody's like, you suck, Johnny Thunder. Mm-hmm. It's like, hey, you know that genie that you conjure up? That guy thinks you suck too. And then by the end of it, it's like he kind of redeems himself and he makes himself useful, even though, you know, his main the main thing that he brings to the team is having control of a hyper powerful magic genie. You know, it's like Johnny Thunder actually gets to do something. And that's like an actual storyline that happens, which is kind of weirdly rare in this book.
I know, right?
You know, it's like Johnny Thunder and that owl get like the most character, like the only actual character arcs in this piece.
And that
it's
is
weird.
Maybe the saddest part about the whole series. So bottom line for me is this is interesting. I think there are better Justice Society stories out there that are more modern. There are better, more modern Justice Society stories that are out there, JSA stories that are out there. This is interesting. I don't know if I would recommend it just because it feels so scattershot, but also very repetitive, if that's possible. And so I can't really recommend it. I really can't recommend it. This is definitely a borrow for me. Check it out from your library, but don't buy it. Matthew.
This is eminently skippable. And I'm going to be honest with you. I love this book for two reasons. One, the idea of the owl on Miraclo is an idea whose time had come.
Yeah.
And two, if nothing else, it provides you with millions of beautiful glamour shots drawn by modern character or modern artists of the characters of the Golden Age mm-hmm. that are reasonably accurate to their original Golden Age costumes, if you're into that. This is the only place you're going to find a decent picture of King Standish in costume. Not sure. that matters to anyone but me, but, you know, then there's the bit where, I don't know if you guys noticed that Dr. Occult lost his soul.
Yes.
At the end.
Yes.
You know, that ties into Sandman, that Vertigo Sandman, where you got your books of magic and your Dr. Occult, and he lost his soul and he has to save it, share his soul with a girl named Rose now. They totally set that up. It's a retcon. Yeah.
Rodrigo.
This is just skippable.
Yeah, it's a hard pass for me. Unfortunately, it's dense, and even though there's a lot going on, it doesn't feel like a lot happens, and the small character moments aren't enough to really salvage it.
Yeah. All right, there you go, ladies and gentlemen. That is Justice Society Returns from DC Comics, various writers, various artists, all over the place. This is not currently in print. You have to get it in from the used book chain that you can find over there at Amazon. So if you want to pick it up, if you're like, oh my God, these guys have trashed this book so much that I simply have to go buy it myself. There's a link in the show notes for you to go buy it and check it out. And I think that's where we're going to end up in the show this week. Thank you so much for listening and thank you for being part of the Major Spoilers experience.
As always, we want to hear your feedback. Tell us we're wrong. If you think we're wrong, use the comments section at Major Spoilers to share your thoughts and reactions to this and every episode. Or even better, you can send us an email directly to podcast@majorspoilers.com.
Yeah, but be nice. And Don't forget, you can support this show and everything we do by becoming a patron at patreon.com/majorspoilers.
We will be back next week because we know that you love comics and we do too. And we will talk with you soon.
Stop talking about comic books or I'll kill you. I don't care if the Hulk could defeat the Man of Steel. I'm gonna rearrange your face if you continue to debate whether Logan's claws could pierce Steve Rogers' shield. I just couldn't care less if they bring back Kraven. Spider-Man's a clone. Stop spending all our cash on back issues of The Flash, or I swear to God you're gonna spend your twilight years alone.
This podcast is copyright 2019 by Major Spoilers Entertainment, LLC.